Okay, so this morning we're gonna do the Manjushri Sadhana. Okay, so the Buddha's wisdom and compassion emanate in a lot of different ways, in the forms of the various Buddha figures or Buddhist deities. And the purpose is in order to communicate with us, because we are beings who are very oriented towards our senses, towards color and shape and sound and all these things. And so the Buddha, in order to communicate with us, has to emanate in those kind of forms, because our mind is too obscured to, have a direct wire to the Buddha's omniscient mind, which is formless. Okay? So the Buddhas appear in these different forms. And so one of the forms is Manjushri. In Chinese, it's Wensu Pusa. And the whole physical appearance of Manjushri represents his internal qualities, okay? Or the internal qualities of a fully enlightened one. Yesterday we were talking about how our body language can, and how we walk, indicates what's going on in our mind, right? So similarly, the appearance of Manjushri indicates the qualities of an enlightened mind. So there's several different forms of Manjushri. There's white Manjushri, black Manjushri, and then this red-yellow, or kind of golden color Manjushri, which is the practice we're doing now. So when you see this vibrant golden color, it's kind of like the sun. And, the sun enlightens the world, doesn't it? When the sun is out, we can see things clearly. So similarly, Manjushri's color now indicates wisdom, the wisdom that can see how things exist clearly, how they exist conventionally, and how they exist ultimately. So all those things are made clear, and that's represented by the color. Manjushri also appears as a 16-year-old youth. I'm not quite sure why it's 16 and not 15 or 17, but maybe because at 16, you're kind of at your prime, and everything's downhill after that, isn't it? So, 16, you know it all, don't you? And then you kind of get a little bit dumber as you age, and you realize that your parents get smarter as you age. You ever notice that? Yeah, how when you're 40, your parents, all of a sudden, they start to know something. So, he's in a youthful appearance, so very attractive. And then the right hand is holding the sword, and the sword is double blade, double, how do you say it, where it's sharp on both sides? Double-edged. Okay, yes. Okay, like the one you shave with, huh? Okay. Now I get it. Okay, so it's double-edged, representing conventional truth and ultimate truth. Okay? So conventional truth is the functioning of the world, how, the multiplicity of all the different phenomena that appear in different ways. Okay? And that they all have their conventional nature. Fire is hot, water is wet. Sentient beings are immersed in misery, So conventionally, things appear, they have their own conventional qualities and nature. But how they really exist, their ultimate mode of existence, when you really explore what is that, then you discover their ultimate nature, which is that they're empty of having any kind of inherent existence. So when we talk about the two truths, this is what we're referring to. Yeah, conventional truths, the multiplicity of phenomena, ultimate truth, the actual mode of existence. Yeah, the conventional nature of things, you have a lot of positive phenomena or affirmative phenomena, you know, the wall, the lights, you, me, the floor, you know, these things are all appearing. When you talk about the ultimate nature, yeah, all phenomena have the same ultimate nature, and their ultimate nature is a negative phenomena in the sense that it's a lack or an absence of a fantasized way of existence that we've projected onto the conventional phenomena. Okay? So emptiness is an absence, it's a lack. Okay? It's not freely taken. No, the mind is grasping at it because the mind's bewildered and confused and ignorant. And self-images and notions about ourself that are total fantasies. And as we realize that we're not that one, and we're not that one, and we're not that one, our minds become more and more free. Okay? So we have many different kind of identities. You know, your career, your age, your gender, your ethnicity, your race, your religion, your, you know, whatever you want to make an identity out of, you know. So things, different categories that, you know, that we fill in, you know, the people who live here, the people who live there. We also have a lot of identities that we make up for ourselves, okay? Psychological type of identities, like I'm dumb, I'm stupid, I'm unlovable, I do everything wrong, I'm guilty, yeah, I'm a horrible human being. Or I'm the best thing that walked the face of this earth, and people are so lucky to have me around. Okay? So we have all sorts of identities that we hold on to. I'm the person who likes this. I'm the person who needs that. I'm the person who has to have this in order to survive. Yeah. So lots and lots of identities that we are firmly convinced that that's who we are and that we aren't any other way. And what we start to realize through Dharma is that we are not those identities. You know, some of the identities conventionally we are, you know, you can say you're, you know, American or Mexican or Taiwanese or, you know, South African. You know, those are existing conventional identities, but that's not who we are. Okay. Some of the things that we construct as identities, we aren't. Okay. So, but we firmly believe we are. Like we get into this thing of I'm totally unlovable. Okay. Are we totally unlovable? No. You know, everybody has somebody who loves them. Yeah, you might not see it. You know, we tend to be very obscured about the people who care about us. We don't see them. Yeah. Yeah. We might have the identity of poor me. Poor me. Poor me. Mm-hmm. Poor me. Yeah, everything goes wrong. Hmm. And you can see I've perfected that one. I have a lot of practice with it. You know, and we identify with poor me. But is that who we are? No. I mean, look what we have going for us in our life. It's really quite amazing. So you see, some of these things that we identify with don't even conventionally exist. Some conventionally exist. You know, you're whatever nationality you are. But some of the things we identify with don't exist. Okay, at all. Not conventionally, not ultimately. In Buddhist texts, they refer to things that don't exist in this way as the horns of a rabbit, okay, or a turtle's mustache, or flowers in the sky. and or weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You know. You know, some things which just don't exist conventionally. Yeah. So a lot of our suffering comes because we believe in these things. You know, we believe in these false identities, you know, and not only the ones, like I said, that don't even conventionally exist, let alone ultimately, but even the ones that conventionally exist, we don't apprehend them in the right way, and we think they inherently exist. So that creates a whole lot of problems for us. Okay? So when we're talking about the double-edged sword, yeah, then one side represents the ultimate nature, that things lack any inherent existence. Okay, so even the things that conventionally exist, yeah, lack inherent existence. And then the other side represents the conventional truth, which is the way that things conventionally exist, which is that they're dependent arising. Okay? They arise dependent on other factors. Things like, you know, the rabbit's horn or poor me, they aren't conventional truths. They don't have a conventional nature because they don't exist at all. Okay? Whereas people, floors, trees, these things exist conventionally, but they don't exist ultimately. Okay, are you with me? The difference between these things? So that's what is meant, you know, by the double-edged sword, the conventional nature, the ultimate nature. Yeah? And then, of course, a sword cuts wrong conceptions, doesn't it? You know, so wrong conceptions about both these natures. Yeah. So when you find yourself stuck in, you know, some kind of self-identity, you can imagine Manjushri's sword cutting it. Yeah. Just slicing away at it. Okay. Then in his left hand, you know, his thumb and ring finger together like that, that represents ultimate and conventional truths, and then the three fingers are the refuges. Okay. And then there's a stem of an opala flower, you know, which is a type of lotus that blossoms by his ear. Did they say opala or lotus in the sadhana? Opala, okay. And on that is the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in 8,000 or 10,000 verses, or the, you know, the essence of that is the Heart Sutra. And that is, you know, on the lotus, representing that if, you know, since Manjushri is the emanation of all the Buddha's wisdom, you know, how do you gain that deep wisdom? It's through actualizing and understanding the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Okay? So there's different kinds. When they talk about perfection of wisdom, there's different kinds. You know, the natural perfection of wisdom is the empty nature itself. Okay? Then you have the scriptural perfection of wisdom, which is, you know, the text that is teaching it. And then you have the path perfection of wisdom, which is all the realizations in the consciousness of, you know, or it's the realizations of emptiness, specifically the direct perception of emptiness. You know, that is what actually liberates us. Okay? So that's represented, you know, by the text. So don't think that the text just means that you're intellectually getting a lot of information. And the text is actually representing, you know, a consciousness, a realization that we want to gain through our meditation. Okay? To gain that realization, we have to study. We have to reflect on what we hear. And then we have to meditate on it. Okay, so often we hear three kinds of wisdom, you know, from hearing or studying, from reflecting or thinking, and then from meditating. Okay. And the Manjushri, of course, is adorned with, the different jewel ornaments that represent the six perfections or the six far-reaching attitudes, and celestial silks, which I can't remember what they represent. Does anybody else remember? Anyway, beautiful clothing from Bon Marché. A special sale of celestial silks. Okay. And then he's sitting in the Vajra position, which some people call the lotus position, but it's actually the Vajra position, with your left leg, your right thigh, and then your right leg on your left thigh. And that represents firmness and solidity in your meditation. Because sitting like that, your body becomes quite firm, and then also the subtle energy or the chi in your body, flows in a better way. Manjushri's body is made of light. It's not, this kind of body. When we talk about, cyclic existence, yeah, what cyclic existence means, it doesn't mean this world, okay? Cyclic existence means our present body and mind, okay? So this thing here is cyclic existence. And why? Because it's taken under the influence of ignorance, other afflictions, and the karma created by those afflictions. Okay? It's not freely taken. No, the mind is grasping at it because the mind's bewildered and confused and ignorant. And so what we grasped at, a body of flesh and blood, is contaminated by ignorance. When we talk about the contaminated aggregates, it means contaminated by ignorance. Okay? Because the body was produced, we took the body by force of our ignorance. Yeah. We live in this body as sentient beings by the force of our ignorance. We create more karma with this body by the force of our ignorance. We experience more suffering in future lives by force of that karma that we created out of ignorance. Okay. And here it's specifically the ignorance that grasps at inherent or true existence. Okay. Because it's that ignorance that gives forth the attachment, anger, resentment, animosity, jealousy, pride, laziness, lack of conscientiousness, lack of integrity. It's all the negative mental factors, the disturbing emotions come by force of this ignorance, because the ignorance misapprehends things. Okay? It thinks things are truly existent when they aren't. Okay? Truly existent, inherently existent mean the same thing. Having their own independent nature. Yeah, not dependent on anything else. Okay, so by force of that ignorance, we got this body. Yeah. Now we get into this whole body is beautiful thing, don't we, in America? Body is beautiful. Yeah. Give pleasure to my body as much as possible. And so much of our life, the time in our life is spent giving pleasure to our body, isn't it? We sleep to make our body happy. We bathe so our body feels good. We go to the gym to work out. Then we have to pay so much attention to what our body looks like. So you have to dye your hair. You have to comb it this way or comb it that way. Yeah, you have to wear earrings or nose rings or pierce your tongue or, tattoo yourself somewhere. Something to make the body look better than it already does. Then, of course, we want good food to feed this body. We want a good sex life so the body feels good. We want the right temperature in the room so the body's good. You know, everything, so much of our life is spent around this body. Okay? And yet, what is it? If we look, just the conventional nature of the body, what is the body? Okay? So if you mentally, you know, cut from here to here and opened it up, what do you see? Flesh, bones, blood, goo, poop, pee. Yeah. How many of you have ever dissected a human body? A few of you, yeah. Not very pretty inside, is it? Yeah. And you know, it's so funny because when we look at people, we're automatically, oh, that one's very good looking, you know, and we want to look good looking. And yet, what is it that we think is so good looking? You know, the sack of actually very disgusting substances. Don't you think? Okay. So we're not getting into the Judaic-Christian thing of the body is sinful and the body is evil and blah, 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 okay? We're not putting any moral thing on it. You know, we don't have to hate ourselves or hate our body. But let's just look at our body for what it is. You know, we spend all day long pampering this thing. And what is it? Blech. Yeah. Shantideva writes this fantastic thing in Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, you know, for when we get attached to our own or other people's bodies. And he has you just, you know, open the skin and take a look at what's there. You know, and then see if you want to hug it and kiss it. Blah! Pretty disgusting, isn't it? So here we can really see how hallucinated our mind is, can't we? You know, here's this bag of junk that we want to hug and kiss. Yeah. So that's what this body is, okay? Taken by force of ignorance, yeah, a sack of goo. And when is it ever happy and comfortable? Okay? When is your body happy and comfortable? Are you totally comfortable right now? Oh, my back hurts. My knees hurt. The cushion, you know, tush hurts. You know, something itches. Something's always wrong. You know, when is this body ever peaceful? Yeah, very seldom. So we work so hard to make it happy. It's really ungrateful. Yeah. Because it's never, you know, we work hard to make it happy. It's never totally happy. And it complains all the time. Yeah, our body's constantly complaining. Yeah, do this for me. Yeah, do that for me. Yeah, never satisfied. And then, you know, after we've spent our whole life taking care of it, what does it do? It dies. You know? I mean, the ingratitude. Yeah, you spend your whole life taking care of this thing, and what does it do? It abandons you at the end. Yeah, and when it abandons you, it doesn't even turn around and say, thank you for taking care of me. It's painful, you know. It leaves us in a flurry of misery, doesn't it? It doesn't leave us in, you know, oh, thank you so much for taking care of me for all those years. It says, I'm going to make you miserable and, you know, be sick and, you know, all this stuff. Very ungrateful thing. Okay. So again, I'm not saying hate our body, but this is, let's just look at it realistically so we can free our mind of having so much attachment towards it. Okay? Because it's the attachment that is, you know, attachment that causes the difficulties in our life. Okay? Yeah, we're attached to this body. If we weren't so attached to this body, you know, we could have a whole different kind of relationship with it, which is what we're aiming for. And that's why we're meditating on the impermanent nature of the body and the dirty nature of the body and the miserable nature of the body, so that we can free ourselves of the attachment to it, because this attachment makes us totally miserable. I mean, just look at our experience. The more attached we are to the body, the more miserable we are. Okay. So I'm not saying don't take care of your body. We have to take care of our body. We have to keep it healthy, you know? We have to keep it clean. But that isn't necessary. We can do that without being attached to it. Okay. The attachment to the body is just this constant obsession with its comfort and pleasing it and, you know, making it happy and, yeah, making sure it looks good. Yeah, gotta have our body look good, because other people are gonna judge us by what our body looks like, and we're gonna judge them by what their body looks like. Pretty dumb. So, you know, when we look at this, we can really begin to understand what ignorance is, how confused we are. Yeah? Okay, is this clear about the body? Are you getting what I'm saying? We take care of the body because, you know, we have to in order to practice the Dharma. But taking care of the body is very different than being self-indulgent with it and pampering it. Okay, so Manjushri's body is made of light, different than our body. When you have a body made of light, it's not taken under the force of ignorance. Okay, body of light doesn't get aches and pains. Yeah, Manjushri's not sitting there going, oh, my arm is so tired holding this sword. Can't I put it down, you know? Okay, so when you have a body of light, there's no aches and pains. Yeah. Body of light doesn't get old. You don't have to worry about, you know, all your wrinkles and your gray hair. Yeah. Body of light that's born from wisdom doesn't die. Yeah. It's not painful. And it's made of light. It's not made of, you know, all this kind of dirty stuff. Yeah. And so that's why we visualize Manjushri's body made of light. Yeah? Kind of a pure body. Which, when we're doing that, this is what we're aspiring to gain, what we're aspiring to become. Yeah? Is a being like Manjushri with that kind of body. And that kind of speech and that kind of mind. And you can see how the body, speech, and mind are all interdependent. So you don't get a body of light without having a mind with wisdom. And you don't have the beautiful speech of a Buddha without having the mind of wisdom. Okay, any questions about this?
What is this word on fire?
Oh, the fire, yeah. I forgot to mention that, thank you. The fire is, fire burns stuff, doesn't it? Yeah? So it's like the fire that burns the afflictions and burns the karma. Yeah? And doesn't leave ash or, you know, pollution in its wake. It just burns it completely. You know, the fire of wisdom.